You're listening to Ruining It For Everyone with your hosts Maggie McPhee and Christopher Harrington. Episode 6, Unconventional Conventionalists. So what have you been up to?
I've been doing my normal stuff. Just hacking about, building and making and working. And while I was on one of Kanan's show, I was on with Ken Bell and Kanan. We talked about the winter movies. We talked about...
Is it that post show, or is it, or does he have another show entirely?
I'm not sure exactly, because he mentioned something about Scruffy Thingy, so I'm not sure if it's going to be, it might be both, actually. It could be both.
Yeah, I think he's doing, if I recall correctly, he's sort of interleaving them. He's doing one week, and then another one the next week, or something like that. I did hear you on Scruffy Thinking a few weeks back, or was it only last week?
It wasn't this week, it was the week before, I guess.
Right. Okay. I'm a little bit behind. I no longer have a gigantic commute, so I'm finding my podcasts are being unlistened to.
I just have no sense of time.
My new commute is roughly 30 seconds. It's the amount of time it takes me to roll out of bed and go upstairs to my study. So, which actually brings me to what I've been doing. I got a new gig.
Do tell.
Yeah, lots of fun stuff. Well, I can't give too much detail, unfortunately, because I've got crazy NDA things going on, non-disclosure agreement. But suffice to say, I'm now working with the folks at Martian Craft, and they are iOS developers and actually mobile developers in general. They have a bunch of really, really talented developers on staff. What they don't have is, or they didn't have, I should say, is a design arm. And Rob and Jeff, who are the founders of Martian Craft, Rob Ryan and Jeff LaMarche, they brought me in, and one of my ex-coworkers as well, into kind of start up the design side of Martian Craft. So I'm super excited to be working with them, because I've worked with them in the past and really enjoyed the experience. They seem to be pretty excited as well.
Yay for you.
I know. I'm so excited. It's going to be a lot of fun. Some of the projects that I'm working on already are exciting and new territory for me, so that's kind of cool. So we were going to talk about CES, because that was a thing that just happened.
Apparently it did.
I actually paid more attention to it this year for some reason than I have in years past, even though this year there was a big kerfuffle about Microsoft not doing the keynote to CES, and whether or not it was CES saying, well, we don't really want you, versus Microsoft saying, well, we don't really want to be there.
Well, they don't want to be there, do they? Isn't this our last year?
Well, that was the whole thing. It's like, do they really need to be at CES? I mean, CES has become this very diffuse expo. I don't think it's necessarily for Microsoft to be there.
No, I agree. Yeah. I have a theory.
So CES is the consumer electronics giant show that's in Las Vegas every year. It's the big place where all of the big names go down and they show off their cool new stuff that's either going to be shown for the first time or available to the public for the first time. It's everything. It's phones, it's computers, it's washing machines, it's range hoods. It's gotten to be pretty much everything, as opposed to sort of computer and consumer electronics centric.
Where you would go to find out about the latest VCR and DVD player.
Once upon a time.
There was no internet.
Right. And that was, and that's the reason for these big expos, is that there was no internet. And, now there is. So, aside from having a place where all of these journalists can gather to do one-stop shopping, is there a place for that? At CES, there was a whole bunch of really cool stuff that launched. One of the big ones was the LG giant 55-inch OLED television, which I'm still kind of drooling over.
Yeah, last year there was a TV focus as well, but it was mostly about trying to hoodwink us into thinking that 3D was this awesome thing that everyone wanted.
Yep.
This year there was still TV, but I think they've resigned themselves to stop hyping 3D. And there was a lot more of a focus on, all right, well, Here's some good TV ideas.
Well, there was a little bit of 3D there.
But I mean, it's part of the product now versus the thing they're trying to hype.
Yeah, exactly. There was much less emphasis on 3D. Sharp did show, or at least I recall them showing their glasses-less 3D, which uses a similar technology that the Game Boy 3DS uses, which really means that you have to be within a certain range of the television, otherwise you're not going to get the 3D stereoscopic effect. Again, you know, last show we talked about 3D, and I'm still not buying it, but it seems that all the high-end televisions have 3D, so I'm stuck paying for it even if I don't want it.
This year, I think the emphasis was on 3Ds are televisions that have brains now.
There was a lot of new smart TV stuff going on a couple of years ago. We started seeing the emergence of apps on your television. For example, I have a Samsung 8500 from 2 years old now. Maybe it's only 1 year old. It's the fully backlit LED, white LED backlit LCD screen, and it has a connection to the internet. It can be either hardwired or you can buy a dongle, which is the wireless adapter, and access the internet that way, which is really great because it allowed you to download the television firmware off of that. But it also had a bunch of apps like Flickr and Yahoo and all of that. You'd watch YouTube. They're very simplistic. They were incredibly slow and slow enough to make them completely useless. I mean, they serve no purpose.
I started out with the Panasonic. So my first smart TV, it didn't have Netflix, but it was a Panasonic plasma. So it did have Amazon Video and YouTube and some other things. And it wasn't quite so painful. Yeah. Now I've got the next generation of that same interface on the Panasonic DVD player, and it also has Netflix and it has a few more things. So it's definitely an evolving market.
Mm-hmm. And I think, my Blu-ray player is also a Samsung, which is lovely because the Samsung Blu-ray player talks to the Samsung television.
Right.
But it has different apps. My television doesn't have Netflix, but my Blu-ray player does. The user experience is really dreadful. It doesn't allow you to search for films. It only allows you to see what's in your queue and then call it up. But
yeah, it irks me because on the Panasonic interface, it's like you're forcing me to use another device. Why are you doing this to me?
Yeah, it's like you have to have everything preset. Everything has to be done on the computer, and then it can be called up from the television, which is a little weird.
Yeah. That's a little backwards.
Yeah. So speaking of television, Sony is trying to revive Google TV.
Yeah. They're not the only ones either.
Did they not see what Logitech went through?
It's Sony. They're the most dysfunctional company that I know of.
Yeah, they're currently drowning. It's so ridiculous because they have so much of an opportunity to take this and run with it. Not necessarily the Google TV thing, but at one point in time, they owned high-end electronics, or at least the mind share of high-end electronics. You went Sony, you went Sony XBR, you had the best television that mere mortals could get. And yes, you paid for it, but you weren't buying the $100,000 Ronco projector,
Right. Yeah, I mean, back in the day, if it didn't say Trinitron on it, you were nobody.
Yeah, exactly. So why are they so failing to grasp where things are going? I don't know.
I think they have a lot of trouble when they're not the initiators of either a device space or some leading device in that space, and they really don't have anything right now that's a leader.
Well, aside from Blu-ray,
that's just the technology though that's shared with the world. So I mean, yeah, they've. I don't know. I mean, it's not like when they had the Walkman, they were the kings there, or their television space. It's like, but when they're just another company, they just can't seem to get their shit together. It's really odd. But that said, I mean, they also maybe, and I can't believe I'm defending Sony, but they also may be seeing what came along with, once the box was discounted, people's harsh opinions softened up, and B, Google came out with this other iteration of Google TV. I'm not also not defending Google TV. I mean, but, you know, it is what it is.
Right.
So, yeah, I totally don't trust Sony to get it right, though. So there's no way I would buy a set-top box from them, whether it was running Google TV or anything else. Mm.
Well, I think
screw it up.
Well, I think the big thing that was wrong about Google TV was that the promise of Google TV never really happened. You know, and that promise was that, you know, the content providers would actually allow it to exist.
Right.
You know, it's a great idea. You know, oh, you just search for what you're looking for rather than flip through channels or what have you. And oh, you know, you want to record this, or, you know, it's all built in. You know, that's really powerful. The television as web service reminds me of the old web TV, which Sony also was in partnership with Microsoft for. You know, and I'm not super keen on that, but I do think that with a simplified interface and content providers who are actually amenable to this whole idea of allowing users to search for things and record them. The idea of Google TV, I think, is sound. I think the execution and having to deal with these third-party content providers proved to be its undoing.
Right, and Google kind of jumped in there and started the whole product cycle, you know, I think, too soon. And I guess in their mind, they were going to Apple it through, you know. They were going to put it out there, and they're Google, and everyone's going to go along with this.
Right.
Well,
part of the problem is that, you know, unlike Android, they didn't sort of just give it out there for free. The price point for these things is way too expensive, and the UI blows goats.
Yeah, now, had it been expensive and people got it and said, oh my God, this is wonderful, it would have been one thing, but it was expensive. Like you said, the UI was horrible, and it didn't deliver what it promised. So, I mean, at least that's fail, fail, fail.
So I hope maybe this iteration is better. I think it's probably merely an iteration. I don't think it's going to be there yet. And again, that's the problem that Apple is having, right? I mean, idea of the Apple television as opposed to Apple TV, the Apple television rumor that's been, you know, surfacing now and again, which I don't think we'll ever see the light of day. You know, they're saying, oh, Apple will make a television and it's going to be IPTV and it's this and that and the other thing. It's like, well, you know, they need content providers, and those content deals are not really going to go through very well because, well, I think Tim Cook can make a mean deal. I think that these content providers are trying to wring as much out of Apple as they possibly can, and Apple just doesn't care. And so the deal's never going to happen.
I think if I had to guess, my guess would be that Google has seen this the real advent of the smart TV market. You know, we've had, like we've discussed, you and I have had these devices for a while that did certain things, but the new market will be every TV is a smart TV, and it will have to run something. You'll either have some screwed up, you know, Panasonic interface, or it could run Google TV. And I think Google's trying to position Google TV where when someone says, we're going to put something in this TV, they can say, well, we can do something, or we can just put Google TV in it. And that's my guess. And if you look, you see that Vizio, you know, the Windows 98 of TV makers, Vizio, they're launching a streaming box, like a $99 Vizio streaming box.
Yeah, they're basically making an Apple TV. As a matter of fact, it looks like a slightly larger Apple TV puck.
Yeah, but they're only selling it through their company and blah blah blah, which is stupid enough. But it has Google TV on it.
Well, Vizio seemed to be doing a lot of interesting things at CES this year. Not only did they announce their little puck thing with Google TV, but they also introduced their thin and light notebooks, which look, I have to say, really sexy. They do remind me of the MacBook Airs, but they remind me of the MacBook Airs less so than a lot of the other competitors of the Ultrabooks.
Yeah.
It seems that in CES, the big push this year was not only the advent of, you know, cool new television technology with the LG 55-inch OLED screen, and the, you know, the bezels that are like 4 millimeters, which really, it really does look like it's just a giant window into another dimension, which is kind of cool. The big push at CES this year was also the Ultrabooks, Toshiba and all them. So the Ultrabook line is sort of a branding exercise from Intel initially to try and get Windows computers into a MacBook Air-like form factor. So entirely solid state, thin, light, running a Windows operating system and Intel hardware. So solid state drives, very minimal I/O, you know, usually just like an HDMI or some sort of DVI connector, and some USB, and that's pretty much it. And they all look exactly like the MacBook Air.
Right. I mean, that's basically the space they're competing in. In a way, they're competing with the MacBook Air, and in a way, they're not. There's a market of people who want or need or must buy a Windows laptop, and when they look at someone and say, you know, I need one of those, you know, the MacBook Air, it's like, okay, that is the analogous to this, here you go. You know, this allows them to buy something in that space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Windows equivalent, because they are tied to Windows in some way, shape or form. But I also think that with regard to the industrial design, yeah, it's pretty blatantly rip-off of Apple. You know, they're all the brushed aluminum design. They all have, actually a lot of them have no button trackpads as well, which I thought was really interesting.
Well, and the Vizios in particular have a sort of, there's a bevel cut out on the sides.
Right.
So that it looks thinner than it is.
Yeah, there's that sort of rolled slope or rounded edge. I mean, the Air does that too.
But this makes it look more like an Air, you know?
Right. And that's the other thing too. Vizio is, I think Vizio's industrial design is actually the best of all of the Windows counterparts, but no one has seen it in action yet. So I don't know how it holds up. They're also marketing it differently. They're not calling it an Ultrabook. They're calling it a thin and light. Does that mean it doesn't have to conform to the Ultrabook minimum specification, so therefore they can come in at maybe a lower price point because maybe they cut some corners? But the industrial design looks fantastic, and I'm waiting to hear some hands-on reviews of the hardware because I think it's got, you know, some promise. Vizio televisions are, you know, they're not the greatest televisions, but
they're not the worst.
Right, they provide actually a fair value. You know. So
that's, in fact, I did, when I sort of gave sideways compliment earlier, I mean, and I called them the Windows 98 of the TV market, but you know, it's a known, it's not going to be the best thing you can have, but it will work well.
Yeah. I mean, their televisions usually give you, you know, a plethora of ports. They give you everything that the average person will need and nothing more. You know, they're not trying to aim at the super, super high end, but they're not going to totally cheap out and not give you inputs or not give you decent sound or not give you decent picture quality.
Yeah, they'll give you an A- or a B display. The actual display, you know, and then the rest will be okay.
And if I recall correctly, they're not merely designed in the US, but I think they're also manufactured in the US as well. Of course, they're doing it from overseas parts, but because there are only, what, a couple of LCD manufacturers like Samsung, LG, Sharp.
There are a lot, yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty much it.
Although I have to admit that I've heard a lot of horror stories about trying to return Vizio TVs or get them a service, but
well, I mean,
that's all hearsay, so I'll leave that
right.
Alone.
Well, also, I think, I've heard that as well, but I mean, I've never heard good stories about trying to return television.
True.
So I'm really excited about the Vizio thing because I do want to see where they fit. You know, where do they net out?
That's surprising to me. I can tell how excited you are. I didn't see that one coming.
Yeah, which is weird. Well, the other thing is that I eventually want to, well, not eventually, but very soon, I want to actually create a gaming PC. My Mac Pro is all very well and good, and it's got a decent graphics card in it, but I don't want to, there are a lot, well, A, there are a lot of games that are available on PC that will never make it to the Mac, and B, I'd rather not crud up my Mac Pro with, you know, game binaries and such when I can you know, when it's primarily a work computer. So,
yeah, understood.
Yeah.
I know what I was excited about.
What were you excited? Oh, yes, 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 yes. Let's talk about
it. The only reason I followed CES to start with, although I do have some, we'll get to talk about later. I do have some opinions about what CES might be now. But yeah, I was really excited about the new MakerBot
that
replicator.
That thing is so cool. It's a dual extruder. It's under $2,000. And it also has a much bigger build envelope. So it's what we said, it's roughly the size of a small loaf of bread.
Yeah, roughly the size of a loaf of bread. I believe it works out to about, it's just under 9 by 6 by 6.
Wow.
Just under that. It's 8.9 by 5.7 by 5.9. And it's so nice. And
so did you pre-order?
Here, no, because I just bought a thing-o-matic.
Yes, so return so? It. No. Sell it on eBay. But you know what? You could donate it to your hackerspace.
Mad Art Lab bought half of it.
So, So you have. All right, fair enough. Right on.
But the big difference is and this is kind of weird for MakerBot, is the replicator comes assembled.
Yeah, I noticed that as well.
Now, I pretty much think I know why, but it's a big change for them, because usually everything is, you know, is a kit.
Right. It comes flat pack and you sort of assemble it. And that's part of the fun too. It's like, here's this thing that you're making, and you're making the thing that makes things.
But I think this machine can actually compete against some of the more commercial machines, which are always so much more expensive, even if they're not really any better. Whereas this, you know, they can ship it and say, yeah, you plug it in, turn it on, it's ready to go.
Oh, interesting. So that the made version, the assembled version, because I believe you can get it disassembled so you can assemble it yourself, or is that not true?
No, for the replicator, they're only offering one that's built and tested and ready.
Pretty wild.
And it has and I think that the reason I think that is I think that using a dual extruder, the Mark 8 dual extruder, it's a big difference, and it's a lot more fiddly. Getting a single extruder to it work is fiddly enough. So my thought on this is that they've said, well, we should put this thing together, get it tested before it leaves to make sure it works, versus fielding a lot of calls with people going, you know, so.
Well,
and
what about
also to compete in that ready-to-go space, you
right,
know.
Right, sure.
Like, we're going to spend $5,000 on this 3D printer. Or we could buy this one for $17.49, you know. So.
Right. But what about, you sort of figure it's probably going to be as fiddly as the existing MakerBots. So if that's the case, do you think that shipping would be potentially a problem? I could see it certainly being, you know, shaken up during shipping and you know, the extruder is no longer lining up properly, or you have some problem with the heater or some problem with some, you know, stepper motor down the line, some belt gets loose or what have you. And then because you didn't assemble it yourself, you don't know where the problem may be.
Well, that is one thing that, like, when you build a MakerBot, when it does something, you pretty much turn and go, oh, that's the, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it becomes really obvious when you make it yourself. I'm super excited. I think it's great, you know, because you can, you can also extrude two different materials if you wanted to, different colors simultaneously. You know, it really does open up the possibilities and makes it a much more viable, much more attractive 3D printer.
Right. Yeah, especially people who are, like I say, looking in these commercial versions that, and some of those are still just, you know, single color, single extruders. So it's very, very enticing, I think. It is for me because I want one really bad.
Oh, just get one. Save up for a couple of months. You'll be able to get one.
I'll get one at some point. Yeah, actually, you can see, if you go to madartbot.com, when you can see, we call her Maddie. And she has a nameplate, nice little nameplate on the front of her. She's offline right now, but all you can see is Bill Nye. But if people are interested, you can go there and watch her print stuff.
So
that was really exciting for me. I was just climbing the walls, waiting to find out what they were going to announce.
Yeah,
which is, you know, a big deal for MakerBot to be one of the big things announced at CES.
I guess that's a question. Was it a really big it was a big thing to ask because we saw the preview and you know, I tweeted it, they're going to announce something cool at CES and da-da-da-da. Did it get a lot of press? I heard about it
not on the Thingiverse, not on the MakerBot site, and not through my normal channels. I saw it on Google News.
Wow. Yeah, I caught
it. I'm like, what?
Very cool. I think I caught it on The Verge. That seems to be my go-to site these days. The downside of The Verge is that, well, I go to their RSS feed because their site is incredibly chaotic. But I love Nilay Patel. I think he's one of the best tech writers going. Josh Topolsky, also very good. Both of them came from Engadget. And during the AOL merger, I think it was during the AOL merger, they just decided that enough is enough and we're going to do our own thing and we're going to do it better. And sure enough, they're in fact doing it better. So congrats to them. They've been doing like total wall-to-wall coverage on CES. And so the sheer volume of information that's coming out of The Verge on CES is, you can't follow it all. But they did have if I recall correctly, they had a pretty big flashy article that they were going to say, there's going to be a new MakerBot and we don't know what it is, but we'll let you know as soon as we do. So that was pretty exciting. But aside from the MakerBot, there were also a bunch of camera announcements, which I thought was pretty cool.
Yes.
So exciting. And some less exciting stuff as well. But the thing I really dug was Canon had some stuff, as well as JVC of all things. They seem to pop their head up. Whenever there's like a new technology, they seem to be the first to market for an affordable version. And then they go away again.
They're like that roommate you have. Everyone's walking around the house and suddenly that one roommate pops up and goes, "Hey guys," and then they go back in the room and you don't see them in for a week.
Yeah, it's really weird because apparently they were the first they were the first ones that did like 1080p. They were the first ones that they were really the first camcorder, weren't they?
If you say so.
Yeah, no, they wound up, oddly enough, they wound up being, the first to market, or at least the first to market for, mere mortals, as opposed to, yes, here's this thing and it costs several $100,000 and you will never afford one. They seem to do that a lot. And then their competitors immediately license JVC's IP and proceed to make better versions of JVC stuff. So the big announcement was that JVC announced a 4K video camera for $5,000, which Red tried to do and failed miserably.
Well, for that price point.
Well, yeah. Well, no, actually, as a matter of fact, they succeeded very, very well in creating a lovely camera, or actually a series of lovely cameras, but not at that price point, not even a little bit, which in fact made me cry. but they have a long history of overpromising and eventually delivering.
Something is not the thing that they promised you.
Which is never the thing that they promised, but often.
Which is great if you're looking for something better.
Right, exactly. Because very often they over-deliver.
I'm still bitter over the Scarlett.
Yeah, well, that was going to be my camera. That was going to be $3,000 for that. Yeah, fixed lens. Yeah, okay, I'll buy that. Yeah, that's fine. Super 35mm sensor. Sure, yeah, down with that.
That will be perfect.
It will be amazing.
I was just imagining all the ones that would be stuck on the sides of cars and,
Yeah.
Yeah, whatever.
And sure enough, the Canon 5D Mark II is still the supreme leader in cheap run-and-gun 1080p footage.
And people are sticking GoPros to cars instead of Scarlets.
Yeah. And the GoPro ain't too bad, I have to say. It's never going to be primary camera.
It's my favorite little camera.
Yeah, it's never going to be primary camera. But, the image quality isn't bad at all. And obviously it's small enough. I mean, the thing is like, 3 inches by 1.5 inches? It's teeny, teeny, tiny.
If you've never held one or seen one up close, it is smaller than you think it is.
You can stick them anywhere, and they're cheap as chips. So you could buy like a dozen of them.
Yeah, and they just announced some new stuff at CES, as a matter of fact, too. So
what did they announce? I actually didn't catch that. Or maybe I did and didn't. I thought it was just old news that they also happened to have at CES. Excuse me, also happened to have at CES.
Yeah, they have a Wi-Fi backpack. It lets you, it adds Wi-Fi to the camera, but you can also connect up to 50 cameras together.
Wow. So, like, so you can do so does that mean you could do live switching? Where you're
going. Well, in theory, if you've got something that can, I don't know what how the streaming goes, but the idea being that you can control these all 50 of these cameras, you know, start stop
from an iPad.
Yes, and there's apparently I guess there's an app for that. And that was there were actually several of these little sorts of cameras coming in at CES. I didn't really look at all of them, but this is a really, you know, GoPro has proved that there is a space here for people to sell stuff.
Right. Basically, yeah, you know, adventure folk, skateboarders falling down, hurting themselves, you know. As a matter of fact,
TV shows wanting to put stuff on people's, you know, bodies or
personal
cars
cams,
or whatever.
Yeah, it's the all Fear Factor, all Survivor, all whatever network. And they're also indestructible. They're so tiny, they've got so little mass that they can be kicked around, you know, without crazy gigantic housing.
Right, and the smart thing these guys did was, all right, we built this camera, and then they built a housing around it.
Right.
You know, because so it's like it's either water resistant, it's waterproof, but it's also, you know, hard acrylic, so it's very, you know, robust.
Super durable.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely amazing. Yeah, those guys.
It's just a brilliant piece of kit. It really is.
Yeah, those guys did a really, really great job with that product. And of course, now we've got upstarts, and that's great because that keeps innovation happening. The competitors, I'm glad that they're there, but they've got a huge, huge task ahead of them to try to beat out GoPro in terms of reliability and innovation. May it continue.
Absolutely.
So we talked about the JVC, the Canon G1X, which is the successor to the G9 and G10, G11, blah, 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 G12. That is really, really cool. It's now got the low light capabilities that the 5D Mark II has and the newer cameras that Canon has put out. It is the G series, the G1X is the latest in this particular series. It is the sort of professional point and shoot camera. It's the one that has a hot shoe, so you can put your strobes on it. It can be remotely commanded. It also shoots RAW, which is the straight sensor data. So if you are a professional, or even if you're a pro am or what have you, you can manipulate the image losslessly. If you've got the RAW sensor data, you can bring down the highlights a little bit. So if they would normally be blown out, maybe there's some detail still there, so you can bring that detail back. Maybe you can bring up some information from the shadows as well without affecting the actual pixels. What you're doing is you're just manipulating metadata. So whenever that picture is loaded, that metadata is also loaded. And what you're getting is an interpretation rather than changing actual pixels, which is really fantastic.
This whole, the thing to call them now is wedding photographer cameras, which it sounds like a slight, but it's not. It's for people who have to take a lot of pictures rapidly and without, you know, changing space, and you don't want to fiddle with the camera, and having an all-in-one that you can just pull out.
And also be in low light, because usually are in a church or in, you know, some sort of very dark indoor environment. And while, you're certainly going to have strobes for certain occasions, very often there are certain intimate moments where you really don't want
candles.
To have that flash. Right.
Right. And to be fair, Fujifilm, with the X-Pro 1, is nipping at its heels for that same market. It's a very nice looking camera.
Yeah, I saw a little bit about that. I thought that they have a new type of sensor that they're using, which allows for that very low light capability. If I recall correctly, it uses, oh goodness, I'm going to screw this up. Yeah, suffice to say, it's not a standard CMOS sensor.
No.
And that has, you know, the three filters in front of it, so it's, you know, exposing the sensor in different ways. It allows for a much higher picture quality with a much smaller sensor.
And it offers interchangeable lenses, which is kind of new to that space. I mean, I know there are a lot of it's not a Micro Four Thirds camera, so people say, well, it's just like that. But so that's kind of a new thing too.
But yeah, I was not thrilled with the Nikon because it seemed to be all the expense of a digital SLR.
Are you talking about the D4?
No, not the D4. No. This is a point and shoot. This is a point and shoot with interchangeable lenses. But it's expensive.
Yeah.
It's
a mirrorless camera.
Right, exactly. Which is really great because you can shoot rapidly. But at the same time, it's really expensive. It does have interchangeable lenses, but those interchangeable lenses are not your standard Nikkor lenses that will fit on a regular Nikon DSLR.
Right.
They're its own thing.
And they can't be, though. I mean, they could be, but...
Well, theoretically, they could be, but if you want to have something that is as small as that particular camera, that's not possible, just because of the way the bayonet mount has to work. But yeah, it just seemed to be like, okay, so the sensor isn't that large in the first place. You know, it's really expensive. And if you've got interchangeable lenses, you can't actually put it in a pocket. So why am I buying this over a DSLR? It just doesn't make any sense, which is also what I think of Micro Four Thirds in general. I'm glad they've got a large sensor, but that sensor is smaller than an APS-C sensor. And it seems to me that on the point and shoot side, they've kind of caught up with regard to picture quality. Like if you take a look at the Canon S1, or S100 rather, and that line of cameras that Canon has, the picture quality is really fantastic, and that camera is very, very small. So, you know, yes, you're limited because it's got, you know, like a 4x optical zoom or something, and it's kind of wide angle, but it's not really wide angle. You know, I'm used to, you know, very fast prime lenses, like a 1.8 or a 1.4 or 1.2. And I think these go like down to either 2.2 or 2.8, which is lovely for a point and shoot, you know, but they're still not quite fast enough. But they're finally able to deal with the low light and all that. So it seems to me that Micro Four Thirds is being squeezed from both sides. On the top end, you've got the DSLR, and on the bottom end, you've got these much smaller, physically smaller cameras that are doing as good a job.
Yeah, it's a really tricky space to be making a device in. But I think that we're witnessing now where it's starting to shake out. So I think in this breed of devices, and then the ones that will follow, I think will kind of guide where that goes, and we'll see. It really is a tricky space.
You also mentioned before we started recording a lot of the new cards that are available. There's a lot going on in that space, and they're all basically getting incredibly large and incredibly fast, which is good because the next generation of video cameras, you know, the JVCs, you know, Canon with their C300. I think it's an amazing camera. It's on paper, it's not as cool as the Red, but I think with regard to picture quality and with regard to just general ease of use, I think it has it all over.
It is a nice, just a nice camera.
Yeah, I would really love to play with one.
I think the biggest point for me was watching people when it was announced, and during the announcement, watching people that, you know, are much smarter about these things than I am, and not hearing a lot of criticism, you know, hearing a lot of, oh, that's nice, or, you know, so that's really what, and then as I started looking at, you know, what they were talking about, because I wasn't watching the announcement live, but then going back and reading the specs of Cameron and then what taking into account what they were talking about, it's just it's a nice, well thought out camera.
Yeah, and it's not perfect. And they also mentioned specifically that this is our entry into this new space that we're creating. Interestingly enough, John Siracusa, former writer for Ars Technica, I suppose he contributes occasionally still, but he's no longer actively writing a lot there, which is a crying shame because his writing is really good. He appears on Dan Benjamin's 5x5 podcast, rather his John's own podcast on the 5x5 network. There we are. And he was talking about Nintendo's strategy with regard to the Wii and not competing against the Xbox and the PS3. And he called it the Blue Ocean strategy. Actually, he didn't coin the term. It's a thing. And it basically means, you know, don't compete in the red ocean. Don't compete in that very crowded space. Go into this other place and you can own the entire market. And I think that, you know, Canon is really trying to do that and to go into that space, which I think is wonderful.
Absolutely, because you know, everyone can chase the leader, but if you're chasing the leader, your innovations will only be incremental, like you say. I mean, and so we have Red, then, well, they have the 5D.
Yeah.
Two and
well, and the
which is also theirs, but
and the G well don't. Right, but and the GH2, you know, it's another, you know, very, very even smaller than the 5D, but still producing incredible image quality simply because the firmware can be hacked 7 ways come Sunday.
But it's like don't follow those things, even though one of them's yours. Find that other, because there are plenty of holes in these markets.
Sure. So. Well, they learnt from the 5D. They learnt that, oh, wow, cinematographers really do want to use these things. They're actually useful.
They will tell you what they want, and yes. All you have to do is build it, and then they will buy it.
They are highly opinionated. And I think from the ruminations that I was hearing was from the fanboys, and I don't mean – actually, I do mean that term in a derogatory way, because I do mean people who are just looking at specs without actually using the device and saying, oh, this is crap, this isn't as good as the Red, and why on earth are they coming out with this when this is also here? It's like, if you don't get it, you're not the audience. Yeah. You know, that's pretty much how that works. If you don't get it, you're not the audience. You've never used it, so your opinion is invalid. What I've seen is that the people who have used them really find that camera to be a very special thing. It is not all things to all people, nor should it be. But I also think that, you know, they are going to come out very shortly with this new, you know, this new camera that they've teased in the product shots, that they're saying, oh yeah, that thing in the corner, that other camera that is in this shot with the C300, yeah, that's later. Pay no attention to that one yet.
And how did that get there?
Right. And that's rumored to be a true 4K camera. And that's going to come out soon-ish. But that's going to be part of this line of, you know, C EOS cameras.
Yeah, well, and it's part of this whole thing is a part of the world we live in now, where, you know, where you don't give us a product and then we all kind of gravitate towards the one that gave us most of what we wanted. You make a product and the whole world tells you what's wrong with it.
Right.
I mean, even Sony, as much as I bash Sony, those NEX, NEX VG cameras that they came out with, you know, interchangeable lenses. Why? Because people said, I want something with an interchangeable lens that costs in this price range and, you know, is AVCHD and does all this other stuff. And I want interchangeable lenses on it, you know, because you've taken away the camera before that was the, you know, the standard def camera doesn't exist anymore that did the same thing.
Right.
And of course, you know, we need something in the high HD space. And so they did.
Sure.
Which is one of the few times Sony's listened to somebody.
Yeah, exactly.
And in fact, I believe I'm going to be buying one of those at work for something.
The FS100?
No. The next VG20.
VG20. I don't think I know that one. Oh, is that the one?
The Sony with the interchangeable lenses.
Right. I thought the I thought the FS100 also had interchangeable lenses. I could be wrong.
Yeah, but I'm just talking about the next VG20 is $1,800.
Oh, yeah, because the VS100 I think is in the 3,000 to 5,000 range.
Right.
Which I'm considering looking at. I'm like, you know, yeah, it's I don't not. Get paid to do cinematography, but
I'm just waiting to buy all the 5D Mark IIs once they hit eBay.
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, as a stills photographer, I'm not giving up my 5D Mark II anytime soon. Actually, depending on what comes out of the 5D Mark III, I may upgrade immediately or I may skip the generation.
I never made that jump because most everything I do is long form. So,
right.
You know, all my cameras record more than 11 minutes at a time.
Yeah, there is that.
Although,
well, go ahead.
I was going to say, one of the things, is it the Nikon that I heard that the record time was like more than doubled?
There are several reasons for
I know.
The quality. Yeah, the 11-minute time limit. One was the formatting of the CF card is in like FAT32, and it doesn't do file sizes over 2 gigabytes. So you're kind of hosed there. And they didn't have the magic firmware that will allow you to just create a new file instantaneously, like where the old one left off. And also, it overheats because it's a stills camera. It's not meant to be recording for that long. There's actually a third, and I don't think it's applicable to the 5D, but it is applicable to some of the other more modern cameras that introduced video capability in their DSLR. The EU has a different tax situation for video cameras versus stills cameras. I believe stills cameras are taxed at a much lower rate. So if you can record for over X number of minutes, then you are considered to be a video camera and you're taxed at the much, much higher rate. So they artificially limit that in order to get around that tax situation.
Oh, I don't remember if it was the D4 or not. I know that one of the big cameras mentioned will record longer, but I don't know.
It wouldn't surprise me. I mean, because the D4 is just coming out, so I can certainly see where it would just be sort of unlimited recording.
Right, and it also has SDHC as well as a QXD card slot. So
yeah, that's going to be really spectacular. And I believe the D4 also has uncompressed HDMI out.
That's very compelling.
And it's 42.
Yes.
Which is uncompressed amazing.
42, and unlike some other cameras which insist on putting the interface over HDMI, they don't do that.
Yeah.
So it's the stream that you want out of an HDMI.
It's basically the raw output, which is fabulous. As a matter of fact, it's what the old Canon HD cameras used to do, the video cameras used to do. You know, they recorded to, what was the HV20s, right. You know, back in the day. They recorded to DV, but they did at a fairly low bit rate. But if you plugged the HDMI port into like a Blackmagic card or something, you could get uncompressed, you know, video out of the sensor. And it was great. It was really, really good.
Well, you know, if you wanted to have a semi-portable switching system, you could carry these little consumer cameras, a software switcher and a Mac Pro, and there you are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was really convenient because the HDMI cable can be pretty long without interfering with anything. So, I mean, you set up a few cameras, set up a switcher, and you're pretty good to go. Something in my universe, or at least my professional universe, Android, Google launched the Android human interface guidelines for Ice Cream Sandwich.
See, we're just like on top of the pulse of America.
Exactly. We are always ahead of the curve. You know, it's important to be 15 minutes into the future. I think. And so this is really cool. So up until now, usually what has happened is it's been a field day. Anyone who made an app could make it any way, shape or form that they wanted. There were no guidelines with regard to usability, graphic design, visual design, user experience design. And what they've attempted to do is codify a lot of things going forward. So with this new operating system, the 4.0 Ice Cream Sandwich, they're really trying to rein people in and have more of a cohesive overall experience, in some ways closer to what is available on iOS. You know, just having certain standard behaviors and certain colors and certain systems codified, and the guidelines too. I mean, you can go off in a low Earth orbit if you want, but knowing that, you know, this is what a standard tab looks like. So if you deviate too far from that, you may confuse your users.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's like they've let all the cats out into the yard now, and now that they've got they're bringing some standards, the cats that know to poop in the cat box, they're going to come in and poop in the cat box, and they're going to follow this stuff. You know, anyone can still do anything. So how it shakes out is going to be the thing to see. It's like, because it's there, it's nice, it's great, but that they waited so long to do something like this, they've always been reluctant to take any kind of control because, oh, it's free and it's open. It's like, that's great, except...
Well, it's only free and open to handset makers because they're the ones that actually have the hardware in order to create a phone which can actually be picked up by a carrier. You know, the idea that Android is open is a little ridiculous because no one outside of Google can commit code into Android's base.
Right.
So
it's like they want the cake and they also would like to sort of eat it, maybe.
Ultimately, that was the play, right? So it's make it freely available to anyone who wants it so that it can be deployed on anything to get, to basically reach some sort of market saturation so that they will, on some level, quote unquote, win. Now, they will quote unquote, win because Google is, at its heart, an advertising company. They sell advertising. So with all of their stuff, you know, they're going to have millions and millions and millions of ad impressions per day, and that's going to make them money. So they don't need, I mean, they're basically dumping. They're just putting something out there to...
That was my other complaint with them. Also, I would say with Google TV too, in a way, although they did a little bit, but it's like they threw Android out there. It was the greatest thing since, you know, sliced bread. Here it comes. We're doing it. Here it comes. Everyone can have it. And then they went silent, you know? It was kind of like, why aren't you marketing the crap out of this thing on Google, the thing that everyone looks at every day? There's been a lot of hands-on, hands-off. It's like, they're like you say, there's the commit control and the code control. But it's free, so we don't want to monkey with anything. You know, no, here, just take this. We're not going to tell you what to do with it. It's like, but you are telling us what to do with it because you control what it can and cannot do. At the heart of it, you know.
Right.
And who can and cannot really use it. It's like, yeah, everyone can have it, but it may or may not work on the platform you want to put it on.
As a matter of fact, it won't work on the platform you're probably going to put it on because they only the code that's in the system is only for the particular Nexus model of that generation. So,
well, I mean, you can become a developer and get a hold of some code, but
well, that's the whole thing. But if you, I mean, and you get the code, it's the code that they have given. So, for example, when you check out that Git repository, you're getting all the code that's specific to the Nexus hardware. If you are making a phone that happens to not have that Nexus hardware, it's using the Qualcomm chip as opposed to a Motorola chip or whatever, you know, you've got all that code, but most of it's useless to you, so you have to write your own code in order to, you know, bootstrap your hardware and get all that working. Right. And the problem is that you can't recommit that back to Google so that other people on that same hardware cannot take advantage of your code.
Yeah, there's kind of a tacit let's pretend it's like Linux but not be like Linux in any way, you know. So I guess, you know, that's really one of the things that kind of irks me about the whole thing. And now we've got this human interface guideline thing, which is, again, I'm all for it. And I hope it reaches wide adoption because Android needs it.
Mm-hmm. Well,
because it's become so scattered and so fractured.
Well, I'm curious because, you know, this is specifically for Android 4, the ice cream sandwich, and how many handsets are running ice cream sandwich? Oh, that's right, one. You know, and so if new phones and phones that are yet to come out are still not running ice cream sandwich and therefore have no guarantee of running ice cream sandwich, because, you know, history has proven that the latest and greatest hardware will still not get the latest and greatest operating system, even if it's released 2 months prior to the new operating system coming out.
And let me let the majority of Android handset owners down now early. It will not run on that thing you have, probably.
Yeah. Because there's no money in it there's no money in it for the carriers, there's no money in it for the handset makers, there's no money in it for Google. So why, you know, and those are the three people that are controlling whether or not that operating system gets onto your phone.
Right.
And you as a user of this Android phone do not have the capability of writing the code and putting it on your phone yourself. So how is that?
In all fairness, too, your phone may not be able to run it anyway. But
But theoretically, if it was truly open, you'd be able to check out the code. You'd be able to take out the bits of 4.0 that weren't working properly or are too bloated, or maybe you just don't seem to need, and try to shoehorn it into your hardware, but you can't even do that.
Right, you're not going to be doing that.
Yeah.
You either get it or you don't.
So,
and I mean, literally get, not like, sorry, not figuratively.
Right. So that was a bit of an Android rant. Actually, in a positive note, I've never been very, super keen on Android, and I'm not particularly an iOS fanboy either, although I do certainly prefer iOS over Android. I also am a huge WinPhone 7, 5 fan as well. In general, competition is good. It keeps everyone hurtling forward, which I think Absolutely. Is really great. So without Android, iOS would be in a much worse place. Well, let's talk about those two. Oh, the Titan 2.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, my God. I mean, I was talking about I've got big hands. The Titan 2 is a 4.5-inch IPS display. It's a higher quality IPS display, like an SIPS or something like that, but it's not an AMOLED screen, which the original Titan was, I believe. But it's a 4.5-inch phone, Windows Phone 7 LTE phone. I can't even consider holding that in my hand and using it like a phone. It just seems so odd to me. I mean, I imagine it'd be really heavy and awkward to use. Ugh.
It's enormous. It's just enormous.
But that said, I haven't picked it up. I haven't used it. So maybe it's great. But I'm also wondering if it's 4.5 inches and it's still using the standard WinPhone 7 resolution, those pixels are going to be pretty big too.
I guess there are ways to get around it, but I don't know. I guess we've never seen that Windows Phone 7 on a larger display, so
right.
I don't know what happens under the hood when it goes outside of its comfort zone.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, it just means that, the pixels are bigger, so you start seeing the pixels. If I recall correctly, like the true next point release of Windows Phone 7, I believe they're going to up the standard resolution, which would be great because I think that having a high resolution retina-like display on a WinPhone 7 device is going to be really fantastic, and it will allow for less ridiculous pixel sizes on these ginormo phones that are coming out. It also has a 16 megapixel camera on the back of it.
Yes. Oh my God.
I can't even, we were talking about my D30 at 3.1 megapixels, and it shot great images because it had great glass and it had a gigantic sensor. It was APS-C size. Nothing was larger at the time with not spending, $50,000 on a Leaf back or something. This thing has a tiny, tiny, tiny little sensor on it. How on earth is it going to really resolve 16 megapixels?
I don't know. It was like the craziest thing. I thought it was a typo.
Yeah, it's so bizarre. And I mean, the lens actually looks fairly large. Yeah. There's a bulge in the back of the camera.
There's plenty of room for it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's the other thing too. I'm wondering, are they using this gigantic form factor not merely to have a larger physical screen, but also so the miniaturization, they can use cheaper parts because they don't have to be as small?
Maybe. And maybe they're like, well, we want, let's, how can we have the, it, 16 megapixel camera? Well, we could make the thing really huge. I don't know.
But that's what I'm saying. The sensor is still the same size as any standard.
Oh, no. I'm just like, how can you've got to put a little bit of something around that. You've got to put some.
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah, there just has to be. I mean, there's plenty of space to move around. So, is it all battery? Is it, because that's the neat thing about the iPhone 4S is, or even the iPad, everyone was wondering, oh my God, how on earth are they doing that? And, how are they getting this fantastic battery life in the iPad? And da 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 da. As it turns out, the iPad is a very, 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 very tiny circuit board and a gigantic battery and nothing else.
Well, you got to think, it's basically sort of kind of the thing, the same thing that can fit in an iPhone. So, yeah.
Yeah. But that's just it. I mean, even the iPhone 4S is a
little tiny thing in a giant battery.
In a giant battery, which is precisely what, you know, a lot of these other manufacturers don't do, because they're not using, you know, the smallest, more expensive parts in order to make their device.
Right. How can we put this standard or semi-standard replaceable battery in this thing, you know?
Right. Versus Apple, who says, this needs to be created. We need this to happen. So here's a crap ton of money in order to create a facility that will build us this thing, and you can have it. Which is just,
well, and I mean, they were amazing. Smart too. And early on, I mean, the original iPod had a LiPo battery in it. No one was doing lithium polymer.
Right.
You know, so they've been attacking battery technology since day one. They were ready for this when the time came.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and of course, now that they are primarily a consumer electronics manufacturer, I don't consider computers to be in standard, you know, desktop type computers or laptops to be in the consumer electronics category, although I suppose they are.
Yeah, they are.
I'm really referring to, you know, the iPod, iPhone, iPad, Apple TV. They're really in the consumer electronics space, much more than the traditional computer space. And
well, the traditional computer space is,
well, it's becoming, right? It's yeah, all converging. It's you know, it's ubiquitous computing. It's transparent computing, and it makes sense for Apple to go there, as much as I may not like it, because my needs are slightly different. They're now producing so much that they're literally buying up all of, for example, all of the flash RAM that can possibly be made. And so they're getting much better prices on everything, which means that the competitors or people attempting to compete can't really compete, because they have the scraps. They've got the leftovers. They've got last year's, you know, model.
Right. And like you said, they're trying to use these off-the-shelf parts otherwise, and then they end up with a substandard device because, you know, they can't, you know, well, we've got to build it like this because this is what we've got to use. And So
we talked about the ginormo phone.
Well, one of them.
One of them,
Yeah, there's also the Samsung Galaxy Note, which is also a big Titanic of a thing, but at least it's kind of billed as, all right, this is a tiny
tablet. It's a tiny tablet. Yeah, it's not. Yeah, I was going to say, it's not really a big phone as it is a tiny tablet. I guess because they,
whereas I like to call it the big iPhone G3GS.
Yes, I was going to say Samsung recently has been blatantly ripping off Apple. I mean, you know, they got caught stealing the actual icons from iOS. And the thing that gets me is that they recently hired the little girl in one of the Apple adverts for one of their adverts. Are you serious? Have you no shame?
Maybe they listen to Steve, steal from the best.
There we are. Yeah, but there's a difference between like steal and, you know, like blatantly rip off and steal an idea, meaning like, oh, that this is cool. I'm going to go with that idea, but I'm going to make it better.
I'm going to build one exactly like it.
Yeah, there's a difference. It's not clone the best. It's steal from the best, you know?
Yeah, if anyone goes, go take a look at the Galaxy Note. If you go to the Samsung page, it literally almost—it looks like you're looking at a rebranded 3GS. But what you don't see is how enormous the thing is. But on the page, if they just moved the camera and took Samsung off the back, you'd be like, "Hey, yeah, 3GS." To their, you know, credit, it has a much more non-crazy 8-megapixel camera.
It also seems to have a stylus.
Well, it does multi-touch, and they have a thing called an S Pen. Why they have it, I don't know. I guess they're assuming that people want to draw and take notes, which, you know, doesn't really work well with your finger.
That stylus actually looks exactly like the old Palm stylus.
It does kind of look like, well, that's what I think we mentioned that. It's like it's the return of the PDA phone.
Yeah, this is like Palm Pilot territory, like color, better hardware, but Palm Pilot. It's as if the iPhone and the Palm Pilot, like the Palm 5, had a baby.
And I think this brings us to kind of to what I was going to say about what I feel about CES now. This whole thing is very important because this mobile device space is, unbeknownst to a lot of people, really rapidly evolving right now, because the movement from phone to future device that you carry around that does all this stuff is really, really ramping up. I mean, yes, the iPhone does so much, and we're already thinking of it that way. But as time goes on, we are going to diverge less and less from the computer modeling that we all know and have grown up with into one that's very, 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 very different, and that what kids growing up right now are not going to compute like we do, and mobile devices are going to be incredibly important to everything that they do.
Oh,
and I think CES is not by design, but just by sheer the forces pressing on it by evolution, is turning more into this kind of consumer, not just consumer electronics, but this consumer device world, where the integration of our worlds, you know, the TVs, the smart TVs, smartphones, a lot of these cameras are smart cameras, you know, all of this is kind of condensing down, where I think that kind of does make CES sort of relevant again, because as you alluded to at the start of the show, the one thing that's there is people who are knowledgeable and report and review and look at and tell people, you know, what's really going on with things, need to get in there and see it, and they need to get their hands on it, because mobile devices is not about, you know, specs anymore. It's not, well, look, this PC has this. Oh, that's great. That's what I want. You know, it's like, it's more about...
I don't know. Josh Sapolsky would certainly argue that point. There was a whole meme going... I'm sure you saw it between John Gruber and Josh Sapolsky. John was basically arguing, oh, specs don't really matter. And Josh was like, yeah, they do.
Well, they do for something
I think they're both right, by the way. You know, because it's possible for them to both be right. Specs are important because you need to have a certain minimum spec in order to be able to accomplish a certain thing, but it's one aspect of a greater whole, and that greater whole is the user experience.
And it's, you were talking about this in the pre-show, which we didn't record, but you were talking about phones and looking at new phones and stuff, and it's like, it really was, well, this phone doesn't have the beefy processor that this other phone, but it's more responsive in some way.
Right. And you know? So to recap, I was comparing last weekend, or a couple of weekends ago, actually, I was comparing the Galaxy S2, which is a fairly high-end phone, you know, state-of-the-art type of phone.
It's dual-core.
Dual-core, whole crap ton of RAM, decent storage space, really beautiful, very large screen, AMOLED screen, I believe. Versus the HTC Radar, which is a sort of a middle to low end Windows Phone 7. And I was playing around with the interface, and aside from just the interface paradigms that were different, you know, one being faster than the other there, it doesn't really matter. That's a personal preference, which one you like better. But as far as the interface responsiveness, this low end single core, almost no RAM, very little storage space, Windows Phone 7 HTC Radar was incredibly fast. It was as fast as an iPhone 4S. It felt that way. I mean, it's spec'd much lower, but the operating system is efficient, and the drawing algorithms and APIs are super, super efficient, where everything just feels fluid. The big thing about a touchscreen is that... In order for a touchscreen to work, because there's no real tactile feedback, like a physical button, you have to completely be on point with regard to the response from your finger. So the smallest touch, the smallest movement, you have to update the operating system, you have to update that view as fast as possible, almost shutting out all other threads so that your drawing thread can interpret that action and respond accordingly, as if you were physically touching a button or physically moving a piece of paper. On the other hand, Android, even with much beefier hardware, it was lagging, it was just a little bit herky-jerky, it was not what I expected at all, especially on, you know, fairly modern hardware. I was very disappointed, although I physically liked the hardware. It felt very nice. The screen was really lovely. the operating system was its downfall.
Yeah, and that sort of thing, that's what you just said. I mean, that sort of thing from someone reporting to everyone else about, you know, the feel and the experience and so forth is important. And I think that some of that comes from CES. It's kind of like the head end, you know. It's like, well, we'll head off all the crap ahead of time so that, you know, you, the consumer, don't have to go look at every phone that just came out. Here's the ones you need to look at. And I think that still keeps CES relevant again. I was fully expecting it to be dead by now. But
well, that's kind of
this year was kind of a weird, like, wow, I'm actually reading about CES.
Well, that's kind of the new thing, though. It's like, it seems to be that, yeah, I definitely think that CES is still relevant. And I think that the plethora and breadth of products that were available at CES reflected that. Certainly the people on the floor reflected that as well. But I think that the idea of the expo has changed significantly since the advent of broadband and blogging and real-time blogging and all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Where I think the large players, the star players, like the big boys, like Apple and Microsoft, they've been shying away from these giant events because those events are always at a fixed time that may or may not coincide with a product cycle. And that artificially limits the company to getting something out at that product cycle. Otherwise, they're going to miss, you know, the news cycle and this and that, the other thing. And also, again, it's red ocean versus blue ocean. Would you want to compete where everyone else is competing? Or are you going to create your own media event when you are the sole voice and you can disseminate your message to the same amount of people, but all eyes are suddenly on you versus all eyes are diffused throughout the entire thing, like of CES, for example.
Right. And here in the meritocracy of the, you know, the internet world that we now find ourselves living in, companies like that, CES may not be their thing anymore, because instead of it being a show where, you know, companies bring the things that here's the things you're going to buy that we're making, it's kind of flipped on its head where they bring you things, they're bringing things in, and then they're coming away being told by the consumer, you know, and by proxy through, you know, reporters and so forth, what is going to work. And companies like Apple don't necessarily come to you for your opinion.
Yeah, no. As a matter of fact, quite the opposite. Right. Usually it is the Marie Antoinette, let them eat cake.
So as the, you know, the red ocean, blue ocean, as these things are changing and some of these companies are trying to adapt, this is actually good for them to figure out what they can give to consumers that consumers really want. And it's a sort of feedback that's different than what they're used to. And you know, if you're trying to figure out how to squeeze yourself into this tight space, CES might be the place to figure it out. Yeah. I mean, you bring a product, but you're not necessarily walking out of there with orders. You're walking out of there with a good idea about how your product fared. I don't know if that makes any sense.
Well, right. It's also a place where, I mean, aside from industrial spying, you can really see where your competitors are in the space. Right. So if they're bringing something to the table, you know, you're bringing something to the table, and you can really see what's going on. You can start seeing your landscape. And I think that in general, especially with large corporations like Samsung, like LG, well, Samsung just looks at Apple and blatantly steals what they're doing. But aside from that, they're usually looking inwardly. You know, they're looking at their own products. They kind of have blinkers on with regard to what the rest of the industry is doing. They're usually trying to run full steam ahead with their own internal plans. A lot of them have a not invented here syndrome, so they almost don't want to look and see what other people are doing. They just want to do their thing that they're doing. Or they see something that is potentially a market opportunity and wind up, you know, rushing to market something to try to be the prime mover or the, you know, the first to market. For example, you know, once the iPad hit and the iPad proved that there was a market for tablet for touchscreen tablets, or rather people interpreted it as there is a market for tablets, even though larger form tablets, i.e. convertible laptops, which were considered tablets, failed fairly well in the market, with the exception of some small other, you know, niche markets like medical and stuff like that. But as it turns out, you know, all these tablets were horrible because they tried to cram in an operating system that was really awful, or they used hardware that was not particularly good, and it was reactionary. You know, rather than trying to go their own way and really taking the time to internalize what it really meant to create this touchscreen, larger than a phone, smaller than a laptop object, they just grabbed a whole bunch of stuff off the shelf and shoved it out there. And of course, they all failed miserably. This year, it's a little bit of that. As a matter of fact, last year at CES, there were so many tablets, the vast majority of them never even made it to market.
Right.
You know, they just said, yeah, that's not going to work out, because they saw their competitors just dying in the field. I think Gruber made a point where what Apple did wasn't, and I'm screwing up the quote, but this is the gist of it. What Apple did was not prove that there was a market for tablet computing, but rather there was a market for iPads.
True.
Meaning that Apple is the only one who could have made the iPad, and Apple is the only one that can make an iPad. There isn't necessarily a market for non-Apple iPads.
Yeah, that's a very unique kind of thing. But on the flip side, the other people, the companies at this show that are, like you said, not like these giant corporations who can't move on a dime, but the ones who are finding that they need to find their niche, they're not moving real rapidly, but they need to move more quickly than these others. And they're finding, you know, all this convergence, you know. So if you're making ultra portable laptops or ultra books or what do you want to call them, you know.
Well, soon they'll just be called laptops, right?
I mean, right,
that's
exactly.
That's clearly the way it's going. You know, for example, you know, with the flooding in East Asia, Southeast Asia, and all that, and traditional Winchester hard drives, you know, going up, up, up in price, you know, SSDs are becoming a viable alternative. A lot of people are looking at them rather than a luxury item as a necessity now.
It's selective pressures. It's evolution.
Exactly.
That's how it works.
And so, you know, it's, of course, Apple is going to bring in a 15-inch Air and probably a 17-inch Air. They're going to be large format. I actually talked about this at the unofficial Apple weblog podcast last week, which should be up, by the way.
Yeah, it's not important that it's an Air.
Right, exactly.
They're going to make thinner laptops.
Right, thinner laptops, story. Because no one really cares about optical media with regard to computing anymore. Yeah, you're still going to have your CD players. You're still going to have your Blu-ray. As far as trafficking files back and forth? No. I mean, that's ridiculous because, you know, quite frankly, DVDs don't hold very much in terms of file size. And certainly CD-ROMs don't either. So what are you going to do? Well, you're going to use cloud storage, or you're going to use compact flash cards, USB thumb drives.
Yeah, and that whole thing about the 15-inch Air thing, it's like everyone's asking the wrong, they're asking a question that doesn't need to be asked, and they're asking the wrong question when they are. It's like, will they make a 15-inch Air? It's like, who cares? That's the wrong question. The question is Apple going to make their 15-inch laptops thinner? Yes.
Yeah.
Are
they going to make them thinner? Yeah. If they can, are they going to make them thinner, faster, lighter? The answer is always yes.
Yeah, exactly.
It's just a matter of time and materials and cost. You know, 5 years ago, they could have done the same thing, but they would have been priced completely out of the market. You know, it would have been 20th anniversary Macintosh territory.
Right.
You know, $20,000 for a, you know, it'd be a gorgeous piece of kit, don't get me wrong, but it would be ridiculously expensive and in a museum somewhere.
But the point I was getting about the convergence there, though, is that the people are making these PC ultra portable laptops, these ultrabooks, whatever. I don't remember what was the word they were using?
Ultrabook.
Ultrabook, okay. Mm. You know, it's now actually relevant what the phones what the phones are that are there and the other devices. It's relevant to their business to know what's happening in that phone space, because the phone space is not just a phone anymore.
Right.
I mean, the iPhone 4, in my opinion, iPhone in general, but the iPhone 4 was kind of like an expectation reset for a whole swath of the market about what people will want in the future. It's like, all right, reset, starting from here, something else is going to come from this. The iPhone 4 is not the thing that will have, people will be carrying in the future, but this is where it starts. So start working on what that you think that's going to be from there. And it affects up to, this whole laptop market, I think. Like you said, the iPad is an anomaly in that whole thing.
I wanted to bring up the tablets that came up again this year. The interesting thing to me is the resolutions on these things. So we've got 7-inch and 10-inch tablets that are having full HD resolution. They're 1920 by 1080. That's really, really dense.
Yes.
That's amazingly dense. If I recall correctly, Apple is going to come out with their iPad 3, probably in the March, April timeframe, given past, two data points are not particularly indicative of anything, but assuming things go on apace, we'll see the iPad 3 in the March, April timeframe, and it's widely rumored to have their version of the Retina display, which of course is going to be 4x the number of pixels. So it's going to be twice the number of vertical pixels, twice the number of horizontal pixels. So it'll be, 1024 by 768. So, 2048 by whatever 768 is times two. Not doing math. In the, so 14, 15, I don't know. Anyway, I've clearly been up too late recently. And so that's going to be a really, really high resolution. I'm quite surprised that, all these tablet manufacturers are going to ship these amazingly high resolution tablets. I'm curious to see what battery life is going to be like. Apple clearly has to up the battery life from the iPad 2. Because the iPad 1, I routinely got 12, 13, 14 hours of battery life on it with moderate internet use, backlight at a reasonable, what I would consider to be a reasonable level, like roughly roughly half, maybe a little bit over half, like 60% or so, with 3G on, with Wi-Fi on. It worked out really well. The iPad 2, not as good. Not bad, but not as good.
The problem there is they're really starting to encroach on some of the limits that are inherent in the battery technology.
Well, it's that, and they keep making the damn thing thinner. So if they're making it thinner, then that means the battery's got to be smaller, which means that you're going to have shorter battery life unless you have radically better and more efficient hardware.
Right. Well, then fortunately, there's only so thin they can probably go.
Well, there's that. Well, that's the other thing, too. We're talking general ergonomics. I find the iPad 2, even though it's lighter, to be much more difficult to hold.
Yeah.
Assuming it's not a case, because obviously then you're just holding the case. But I find that it digs into my hands quite a bit, and I find it slippery and difficult to grasp, whereas the iPad itself, maybe because I've got big hands, but I really think it's because the edge of the iPad doesn't have that slope the iPad 2 has, and I just find it much more comfortable to carry and hold.
I find them both slippery, so I always keep it in the case.
Yeah, I mean, in general, I keep mine in my case as well, but it is such a beautiful piece of kit that you want to take it out and sort of hold it.
Yeah,
and,
every once in a while.
Yeah. Well, okay. Also, the case gets a little bit funky, and so you need to clean the case out. And so there's that. Yeah. There's that as well. Have we hit everything?
Maybe.
That was another episode of Ruining It for Everyone with your hosts Maggie McPhee and Christopher Harrington. Music provided by Kevin MacLeod. You can find us at ruiningitforeveryone.tv or search for Ruining It for Everyone on iTunes. Be sure to subscribe and rate the show, as it really helps us out.
Welcome, my unconventional conventionalists.